This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Tony Hillerman, who died in 2008 at the age of 83, was a master of the detective genre and an important writer in detailing life on the Navajo Reservation. His several novels featuring Navajo police officers Joe Leaphorn and Jim Chee have been acclaimed for their accuracy and for their ability to combine Navajo history and thought into strong plot-driven novels. There are four interviews with Tony Hillerman in the Probabilities and Bookwaves archive. This third interview, conducted by Richard A. Lupoff and myself, was recorded on January 30th, 1997 in the KPFA studios while he was on tour for his novel, The Fallen Man, the 12th in the Leaphorn Chee series. In the interview, he also discusses his 1995 novel, Finding Moon, which is not in the series.
This is Richard A. Lupoff.
And I'm Richard Walensky, and our guest is Tony Hillerman, whose latest novel is a Joe Leaphorn Jim Chee mystery, The Fallen Man. Previous novel is out of his series, Finding Moon, and that's where we're going to start, and I'll turn it over to Richard A. Lupoff.
Well, for starters, Finding Moon was, I believe, a 1995 novel.
So right.
It's not that long ago. But it takes place entirely in 1975, in a relatively short, concentrated period of days, I believe in May 1975.
April
75.
3 weeks, I think it was.
What is the reason for this?
Well, I'm going to skip all the way back to the right after World War II, when the colonialism was ending and the Belgians pulled out of the Belgian Congo and left three tribal factions struggling for control, and Stanleyville in flames, and I'm in my 20s and eager to write a great novel, and I think I'll send some Joe Pilgrim to Stanleyville, you know, to look into the accounting of one of the, you know, diamond companies or something and get him caught up in this, see. So I tried to write it then, and I couldn't. So I tried to write it again about 10 years later, still couldn't. Finally, in 1975, you remember, we evacuated an embassy in Saigon.
Indeed, days of high drama and low tragedy.
Yeah, all sorts of chaos. And I thought, well, everybody's forgotten about Stanleyville. Here's another chaotic scene. So I tried to write it again. Still didn't have what it took. One day in 1980, I read somewhere that you lose 830,000 brain cells a day, dying off. And I'm thinking, you know, I better get, if I'm ever going to get this book written, and I never got it out of my mind, I better do it now, and I'll switch it from Stanleyville to Southeast Asia. And by now, I was going to take place in the Philippines. So I went to the Philippines and went to a cockfight and went to that little prison on Palawan Island and did all these research things. Couldn't get a visa to Cambodia or Nam. Went home, let it stew a while. Finally, I wrote it. So long answer to a short question, but that's how it happened. I wanted to get it out of my system.
Richard Walensky.
It's very different from your books that take place in the American Southwest in that it's not a mystery, it's more of a thriller. How do you compare the difference in writing the two different sorts of plots?
Well, in Finding Moon, the whole story is wrapped up in the title. The chief character, the character, the protagonist's name is Moon Mathias. His nickname is Moon, and he's got himself pretty well figured out. He's not a young man anymore. He knows who he is, and he's got a fairly mid-level notion of himself. No hero, certainly. What makes it difficult is you got to, without rubbing anybody, without subtly show your reader the evolution of a man B out of man A. The whole thing turns on the changing character of this fellow. That's why I had so much trouble writing it when I was younger. I didn't know enough about it or how to do it, and it was hard to do. you find yourself doing a lot of going back and rewriting when you – anyway. Meanwhile, you're trying to hold interest with the tension, all that jazz.
Aside from the thriller aspect, I don't think it's giving away any terrible secrets to say that the driving spring of the novel is the search for a missing infant.
Yeah.
But but that struck me as more of a plot device. And as I read the book, it seemed to me that there was a much deeper theme than that, a rather somber and very serious one involving the acceptance and coming to terms with loss and death. Moon's brother's death precedes the novel. We have flashbacks to the death of Moon's father, and we know of the impending death of Moon's stepfather, severe health problems by his mother. And there is a woman, I'm not sure I pronounced her name right, something like Mrs. Weingarten.
Yeah,
whose brother is also imperiled. So we have the death or possible or impending death of about four or five major characters in this novel. And the way Moon, Matthias, and Mrs. Weingarten deal with these situations.
Well, true. When I started that book, I realized that it was the mood. I was going to have to very early on establish a mood, and the mood was important to the story. This, as you say, a somber mood. I don't know how to expand that much. But true enough, the deaths of those people and, of course, of his good friend. It seemed to me as I was writing that book early on that if I could make that book work, it had to work in that confessional in that Manila cathedral. I remember going in that cathedral when I was doing the research and looking at it and standing there and watching people come in and out. It was a rainy day. And thinking that right here probably is a key to this book. It's going to be my one and only opportunity to let the reader see why Moon feels the way he does about himself.
I thought the priest with whom he has, it's more than one-sided confessions. They're really lengthy dialogues. And yeah. I thought the priest with whom he has these conversations was a wonderful, fascinating character. I always enjoyed the scenes where he was on stage. And yet I also had a slight feeling that he was maybe a little bit too flippant and lighthearted in dealing with these profound issues.
That thought occurred to me too. And then I thought, I always try to put myself in the mind of a character. You know, I've tried to understand them. Sometimes you can, sometimes you think you can, and sometimes you're just lost. This guy, I thought, how would it be to have that awful chore, sitting in that cubicle for hours, listening to the same old sins recited over and over and over and over again? Wouldn't you build up a little scar tissue? Wouldn't you become flippant? And certainly, I'm sure that he heard sins confessed that were much worse than what Moon was admitting and more worse tragedies.
So, I imagine putting ourselves in this fellow's cassock for the moment. When he hears endless hours of confession, the great majority of the things he hears are probably of the order of, well, I was walking down the street and I saw this very attractive young lady and I imagined her naked. And the priest is sitting there thinking, been there, done that, boring. But then every so often, whether it's 1 in 100 or 1 in 10,000, something truly monstrous comes through the grill.
Yeah, maybe you're right about that. In fact, when I get home, I'm going to go back and reread that and see if I agree with that you have a very legitimate question about that.
The book moves geographically from Colorado to California to the Philippines and eventually to Southeast Asia. It also involves a certain amount of hardware because they get involved in the last days of that war. How much of this is drawn from your experience in World War II?
Well, some of the notion of the casual way people are killed come out of World War II. But the hardware, you know, let's face it, it was a long World War II. It was
an
antique war. I thought, okay, 75. I had a little trouble. I said, what kind of an armored personnel carrier? You know, the kind that used in 75 are obsolete now. So I thought, I found a National Guard unit that had the old obsolete armored personnel carriers and a very cordial sergeant who was fixing one up, and he let me get in it and almost need a shoehorn to get me out. I'm not built for armored personnel carriers, but he showed me how everything works and all that stuff. And I had great cooperation out of him and also out of these guys in the Brownwater Navy. My oldest son had a good friend who was in the Brownwater Navy. A fellow who helped me write an earlier book, a railroad engineer, was in the Brownwater Navy. And between the two of them, and another guy who fought in Vietnam, a good friend I play poker with, helped me with a lot of that stuff and also with describing the climate. I had them read it, and they say, well, you don't have it hot enough, you don't have it humid enough, you know. So I did have to pick other people's brains.
Richard Walensky is very eager, but let me squeeze in one more question here, which has to do with the learning experience that Moon Mathias goes through, which seems to me to pervade the book. It's almost like the education of Moon Mathias. One of the things that he deals with is learning about the many, many different Asian nationalities and subgroups within nationalities and the way they relate to one another.
Yeah, yeah. I'm hung up on that a little bit. I love to remind people that there aren't just two kind of people, us Americans and all them other people, that there are a dazzling variety of ethnic groups and racial cultures and so forth. So anytime I get a chance, I do that, and here was a great chance. And I wanted to show Mathias as being educated about like the average American is, knowing absolutely damn near nothing about that, you know.
But he finds out.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he finds out is that Southeast Asia is reminded me of the Balkans, where every time you go over a mountain ridge, you find yourself dealing with people of a different ethnicity, and they all hate each other.
Isn't that too bad? I think it's unfortunately true. It's certainly true from what I found out about Southeast Asia going back 1,000 years.
You have some of the action take place on an island prison in the Philippines. I assume this place exists, does it?
It does indeed exist, and the warden was very cordial, and it exists almost exactly like I described in a book. Palawan Island has 17 miles of pavement. There's six cabs on the island, and they're all World War II Jeeps converted, and I took one out to the prison, and we're driving down a road between irrigated, you know, rice paddies. Two guys get out of a little bamboo shack and pull a log back off the road, and that was the gate to the prison. No guns in the prison. It's a hard case prison, had 2,500 inmates. The warden told me their maintenance, it cost them 65 cents a day. After the guys have been in there, certain percentage of their sentence, they get to bring their wives or their girlfriends or their children in. They run a school bus in from Port Princess to pick up the kids to go to school. They give them a little rice paddy to farm or something, and they get a keeper percentage, and percentage goes into the prison communal pot to be probably maybe partly stolen. But, you know, anyway, they have none of this kind of brutality that you see in American prisons. I thought they were lucky fellows.
Your latest novel, The Fallen Man, returns us to the world of Jim Chee and Joe Leaphorn. Only now Leaphorn is retired and Chee is an acting lieutenant. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the change in their psyches from your previous novel to this one, because they seem to have gone through changes.
Well, okay, take Chi first. Chi is already decided he does not like being a bureaucrat. He likes being out on the road, you know. And he's being a bureaucrat because he's trying to woo a lady who he thinks will be impressed by the income and the rank. And that troubles him because he's a Navajo and you shouldn't be impressed by such things. Okay, now Lee, here comes Lee Porn, an uneasy fellow in the role of civilian, which is a distinctly lower caste if you've been a policeman, you know. So you have a relationship between a boss who's now approaching a former employee hat in hand and a former employee who, while he resented his boss, also admired him, not knowing how to deal with him as a lowly civilian. I had to do a lot of thinking about how to handle that, and I finally got it, so I thought it was understandable, I hope.
It seems that she is growing up.
I kind of think that, too, and he's not sure he likes it.
Who does?
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice?
Well, Tony Hillerman, a great deal of the book takes place at or near Ship Rock. Does that place exist?
Pardon me? Ship Rock? Oh, yeah. In fact, there's a photograph of it on the back of my book. You can just see the tip of it.
Oh, that's Ship Rock.
Yeah. And the ship, the town, they spell them different ways, oddly enough. The mountain is spelled in two words and the town one. For some reason that I'm sure it's probably a typographical error that just continued on for 100 years. Yeah, it exists. It's a spectacular piece of geology, and you can see it for 50 or 60 miles. It's imagine taking the World Trade Center off the tip of Manhattan Island, adding about 50 stories and setting it down in a grassy prairie in the middle of Kansas.
Did you ever climb it?
Oh, no.
Did you take a helicopter ride over it?
No, I didn't do that either, except in my imagination.
You've also got mining, a subplot involving mining on the Navajo reservation. I'd like you to talk a little about that. Is that purely from the imagination of Tony Hillerman, or is something else going on?
Of course, the Navajo reservation has loaded with coal mines, largely in the uranium mine. But what I guess stimulated that was I used to go trout fishing on Red River in northern New Mexico, north of Taos, and there's a molybdenum. Let's call it a moly mine. Been there for years and years. It used to be a shaft mine, but it was bought by Union Oil or Southern Standard Oil of California. Somebody bought it and the mining company and expanded it and made a strip mine out and took the whole top off a mountain and built these theoretically unleakable sludge ponds, which leaked and poured acid and everything else down in the Red River and killed all the trout and destroyed. Okay, so you know, I thought, what a shame, and I still think what a shame. So there's a beautiful valley destroyed in a sense because somebody wants to make a lot of money, right? And he'll spend it and die, and we're left for the next 1,000 years with a huge scar. So, okay, you know, you're always looking for a way to grind your own axe in a book if you can get away with it. So I ground my axe.
What about the cattle rustling? Do you have any opinion about that?
My brother and I once tried to make a living with cattle. But I don't approve of cattle rustling, but I needed a subplot, frankly. And I thought, okay, I needed another character. I needed a subplot. I brought in the brand inspector. And he was, as I planned it, a very amiable fellow, and I named him in the draft Dick Pfaff, the name of a good friend of mine who I play poker with. See, I'll make Pfaff a brand inspector. But then as the book began developing, I began seeing need to make this guy a scoundrel instead of a amiable fellow. And so, you know. So finally, I think, you know, I told Pfaff I was doing it, but I think I better show him this. And I showed it to him, and he laughed. Yeah, that's fine. He didn't care. But he made the mistake of showing it to his daughter. She thought it was – she didn't want her dad depicted as this rascal. And so he came to me rather embarrassed and said, well, maybe it would be nicer if I would change the guy's name. But anyway, that's what doesn't have much to do with the question. Oddly enough, the way the brand inspector uses to drum up the cattle to find wet cows, and he tells the Navajo cop he learned it reading New Yorker magazine. That's exactly where I learned it. Believe it or not, an article in New Yorker magazine. One of these profiles of a Nevada brand inspector.
There are the relationships not only between Leaphorn and Chi, which now becomes a civilian police relationship, but also between various kinds of cops. And the brand inspector is a kind of cop.
Yeah.
But a very different kind from a Navajo tribal police officer. And they don't really harmonize very well.
No. No, they don't. And, well, the captain gets along with him because the captain's raising expensive cattle. And he's, you know, their friend, sort of. But, no, they don't harmonize very well.
There are other group relationships as well as individual relationships. We were speaking a few minutes ago of relationships between different Southeast Asian ethnic groups. But here we have the Navajos and the Utes, and in particular a region described as the checkerboard. Would you tell us what that's about?
Well, first the Utes. The Utes, in Navajo mythology, the traditional enemy in many of their myths are Utes. They had a sort of inter-side across the border war going on with the Utes for years. It's raiding back and forth, and it shows up in their mythology. Oh, the checkerboard is the way back when the Senate was trying to turn the country over to the railroad moguls and get the lines extended to the west. They were giving, 30 miles on each side of the right-of-way to the railroads, or half of it in many cases, because they wanted farmers and stuff to grow stuff to ship on the railroads. So they checkerboarded in the 1 mile sections. Railroad would get a mile, and then the public domain would keep it the other mile square. And a lot of these public miles became part of the Navajo reservation. But the private miles were sold off by the railroads, see. So you have the Navajos bought a lot of it back. But, you know, you have a real weird jurisdictional situation.
And this still exists.
Still exists, yeah. And they call it the checkerboard reservation. And it's the east side, and it's checkerboard in other ways. It's full of it's a mixture of Navajo, Laguna, Acoma, Indians, Presbyterians, Catholics, Mennonites, Mormons, born-agains, all kind of missionary activities, see. And also the Native American church. In other words, all these contra-Navajo religions. So it's checkerboard in all sorts of ways.
A lot of the book deals with the relationship between the Navajo way and the American way in terms of what's right versus what's legal, in terms of fame in particular and success. How do you see these two different elements coming together? And is it possible to have, say, a Navajo Madonna? Or would that just never happen because as soon as the person reached a certain peak, they'd pull back?
Okay, a Croatian, a Cambodian, a Irishman, all of them can be totally assimilated. And you can assimilate a Navajo just like you can assimilate me. You know, they can become totally acultured and for their own culture. So you could have a Navajo Madonna. And certainly a good many of them are a lot more beautiful. But you can't have a traditional Navajo Madonna. First place, they're very modest, traditionally. You know, the long skirts. Second, let me tell you about a guy. One of my Navajo, I know his brother is a bareback rider. Rodeo is the number one sport on reservation, and rodeo is the number two sport. And you get down to seven, you get to basketball. You know, the rodeo, they love it. And he had won a series of belts, and the tribal fair rodeo was coming up, and I asked him if his brother was going to compete. And he said, I don't think so. I said, why not? And he said, he thinks he's been winning too much, getting out of harmony.
Well,
and if he does compete, he won't win, he said.
You said,
in other words, he won't compete very hard.
You say in the book about a runner who would win two or three races and then not run or lose on purpose for that reason.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that happening. I've had coaches tell me about that in their track teams.
So what happens with a Navajo who needs to lead the reservation somehow? You know, what about a Navajo who wants to speak as a lobbyist for Congress and wants to be traditional at the same time? Is that possible?
I presume it is. It's difficult. There's a rather famous physicist in the Manhattan Project named Fred Young, who was adopted by a couple in back east and was a brilliant young man, brilliant child, and he got a PhD at Harvard, and I believe it was Harvard anyway, at MIT probably, became a physicist, worked at Los Alamos, was well aware he was a Navajo, and his BBC television, hope I got this right, it's happened years ago, got him to go back to his home chapter house, I forget where it was, Lukachukai or someplace, and they wanted to do a documentary on this guy. And he went along with it. And so there he is at his chapter. And he's introduced. Nobody applauds, which would be Ka Navajo. They sit and they listen to him. And first place, they've already been rude traditionally because of the way they introduce him. You don't say this is Fred Young, physicist. The guy that introduced him said, this man is the son of, and mentions his mother and his mother's clan and his father and his father's clan and his uncles. And okay, that's who he is. Doesn't mention that he's a nuclear physicist. Doesn't tell him his name, which would be rude. And then Fred Young has the floor. And I'm sure I saw some of this years ago, this tape they made. I'm sure about then it was beginning to dawn on Fred that he didn't want to be here under these circumstances. And that the people he was talking to, a jet goes over, and these people he's talking to don't want to be part of that world that's flying over in that jet. And what he's doing is really Ka Navajo, you know? It's a very strange tape. I wish I had a copy of it. In other words, you see my point? A better point, a guy I know personally, he wanted to be a surveyor. He liked that kind of work, and it kept him outdoors in the fresh air and the sun. And he got proper credentials, and he got a job with EG&G or one of the engineering companies who was surveying power lines, working for him several weeks, loving it. One of his relatives has a stroke. They're having a Yabiche ceremony for the relative. He gets the word. Well, he needs to be there. This is far more important. His family, he's a Navajo, his family and his responsibility to his family are immensely more important to him than his own life. So he goes to his boss, and the boss says, we're behind on this. We got a contract. We got penalty fees to pay. We need you. And I don't have any time off coming. You're just with us. He left anyway, went back to the curing ceremony, lost his job. And he would do it again, I'm sure. Different value system.
It is a different value system. I think in one of our conversations several years ago, we talked extensively about Hosro. And I think that fits in here. Would you repeat a little bit about Hosro?
Well, it's we translate it to mean something between beauty and harmony and joy, I guess. And it's the goal to attain it. And what it means is to be in tune, content, happy with whatever the circumstances are, whatever the environment is. Instead of trying to change the world, you conform to make yourself fit into it. Somebody does something outrageous, you know that he's out of harmony, he's sick, you try to cure him. You don't try to punish him. or hang him. You try to have the proper ceremonials that click him back into tune with society. See, that's a rather simplified version.
Well, but this leads to two, I think, very important questions. One is, what do we do with someone who does not click back in? If we have, as we think of it in our urban environment that we live in, if you have somebody who's just plain a bad guy, a professional criminal, the second question, and maybe the answers could all fit together, would be, what does this say about the role of a policeman, which I think is very different from a city cop here in Berkeley, California, or someone in Chicago or New York?
At least it used to be. Well, it's a complicated question. How do I answer it? In the old days, the guy would be shunned and excluded. Now, we had a strange case a while back. A bunch of people got drunk out near Monument Valley, had a party. There's a consolidated school out there and had a big party. And apparently it was really rowdy and a lot of fighting going on. Somebody called us police. They went there, two state policemen. And a fight developed, and they were both killed. And they were put in their car and burned up. Okay, so that's a federal offense on a federal reservation. Here comes the good old Federal Bureau of Ineptitude. And, you know, how many witnesses? Probably 80. But nobody says a thing, see. They can't get anybody to identify anybody. And why not? And why not? Because it's a sort of a traditional area. These guys that killed these cops were drunk and they were out of – I mean, obviously something wrong with them. They need to be cured. It doesn't do any good to arrest them and put them in prison. That's not going to cure anybody, not going to restore harmony. So it was about a month before anybody, the cops, knowing these guys were friends of the policemen, the Navajo tribal policemen, they finally figured out, got people to talk about it, and they made the arrests. And justice in our U.S. sense was done. Whether it's better or not, who knows?
But how does that account for the Jim Cheese and the Joe Leaphorns? What can they do if they're traditional Navajo?
Well, in my book, when I write about them, I kind of have them, wink at the law. I suspect they do that some. I'm confident they do that some. You know, they apply their Navajo value system to what they're enforcing. And, of course, some of the cops aren't Navajos. One of my good friends is a Texas redneck, self-described, but his wife and children are all Navajos. So he considers himself a Navajo. But you know what I mean? They're a mixture. And some of them are assimilated and some of them aren't.
What do the Navajos think of Tony Hillerman?
Well, I was very uneasy about that for a long time. And then I got a call asking me to come to the Navajo Tribal Fair, and I thought, I went. They wanted me to get on this horse and lead their fair parade. And I looked at the horse and told them they had to find an old, fat, tired horse. So anyway, they went and got an old, tired Chevrolet convertible, and I rode in it. But anyway, then they gave me a plaque that the council had voted, which declares me to be a special friend of the Navajos for my accurate and sensitive depiction of the traditional Navajo culture.
That's great.
And I love that. And they use my books in their schools. And in fact, the last thing I did before I came out here was answer a whole bunch of letters from sixth graders or seventh graders at the middle school at where Ganado or someplace where they use it. And the teacher said, all right, now you read the book, you got to write the author a letter. And they say, what are we saying? And they say, well, ask him how he gets his ideas. You know, all of them are saying
the usual stuff.
Yeah. Anyway, it's one of the sources of great satisfaction to me that I've gotten. Only twice I can think of where I got any sort of real partially hostile criticism. They were both young people, and in one case at least, it was what we call city Navajo. Never really lived on reservation, and really didn't know hardly anything about her culture. I think the other guy might have been a city Navajo too, but the old timers, I don't have any trouble with at all. There's people who want me to get involved in this Navajo Hopi, this dispute between the Navajos and Hopis over their joint use problems. And the one thing I resolved early was not be one of those white guys who butts into Indian politics.
I think we're living in an era when ethnic consciousness is rising. The old concept of the melting pot, where everybody would come to America and we would all just become generic Americans, I think that's pretty much been abandoned in favor of diversity and multiplicity of identities within the American character. And I'm wondering now, first of all, if you agree with this, and if you do, how this impacts the Navajos and the other tribes which survive in the country.
I don't know. I'm not so sure you're right. I hope, in a way, I look at the Balkans and I look at the tribal warfare in Africa, and I sincerely hope you're wrong. And I think you are. The middle-class blacks I know, for example, are extremely, almost avidly hostile to Ebonics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They say, yeah, you mean like in Great Britain, where you teach your ghetto people Cockney so you can identify them immediately and keep them in the ghetto, and they don't have a chance. The first time they open their mouth, you know they're underclass people. And they say, yeah, the kind of blacks, the black leadership that's preaching that is a people who are afraid they're going to lose their following if their following moves into the middle class, which is, I think, probably pretty absolutely correct, because most of the immigrants I know are Hispanic. They are desperate for their children to learn middle class English. They know that the good jobs lie in the language, and you and I know it too. And we also have up there a language I can't speak, which is a ruling class language, which is spoke inside the Beltway and in among the anointed Silver Spoon graduates of the Ivy League schools and the Seven Sisters. That's an exclusive language that probably you and I haven't cracked yet. Anyway, I hope sincerely that we do not return to segregation. I grew up in segregation. I hated it. And that's what some of the leadership, minority leadership, is striving for. Return to segregation. I hope we don't return to segregation.
But I still have to pursue this a little farther, because we look at attempts to preserve traditional cultures, as what we're talking about is Navajo culture, but this could, you know, we could make a list as long as our arms.
Yeah.
Is there a way to harmonize, speaking of harmony, the concept of preserving traditional cultures, which have great richness and value and beauty, and without balkanizing America?
Well, sure, you could. Yeah, I think so. I mean, for example, a couple meet at Northern Arizona University, two Navajos. They fall in love. They get married. Then when they go home, when A takes B home to meet his family and clan, they find out his wife belongs to the Salt Clan. Her father was a Salt Clan, so she's born for the Salt Clan. Her mother's clan was okay, but her father's clan is her husband's sub-clan. Okay, so they've got an incest problem. You and I wouldn't recognize it. So there's consternation in one family, not in the other. And both families are kind of split over the issue. Okay. Now, a friend of mine was a tribal judge who had to rule on this case. Boy, what a problem. But anyway, they decide, and this is how they survive. with the white people, keep the hell out of it. They talk it over. They decide they need to have a blessing way ceremonial for the both all the clans, all the people involved, both families. Who to pick? Okay, now we're talking about making the modifications with modern culture. They pick a friend of mine who's a professor at Utah State University. He's a white man, but he's got great friends in both clans. Will you be the patient in a blessing way, the principal patient? He says, okay, I will. I'd love to, but it takes 7 days, and it's right in the middle of the semester. Okay, and the dogma of traditional Navajos is it takes 7 days. One thing I love about Navajos, they say, we'll split it into 2 weekends. According to Changing Woman, you couldn't do this. They do it that way. Everybody comes. They get into the flow of the harmony and the love that you get in these things. And the problem goes away. They accept it. Okay, that's how you assimilate. They start making some adjustments in ceremonial systems so that people can hold a job as a surveyor and still be a Navajo, see, or et cetera.
Tony Hillerman, The Fallen Man deals with Chi and Leaphorn. Your previous novel, Finding Moon, does not. What do you have on tap?
I'm bogged down in another book involving Chi and Leaphorn. And it also involves a vector control specialist, one of these people that hunts down the source of bacteria or virus spread by insects or animals, and who's going to come up missing. And it's going to involve a friction between Navajos and Hopis over eagle nests, over the poaching of eagles by, you know, off the other tribe's land. And it's a long ways from finished.
That novel was titled The First Eagle and was published in 1998. You've been listening to an interview with the late Tony Hillerman, who died at the age of 83 in 2008, discussing his novels The Fallen Man and Finding Moon. It was recorded January 30th, 1997, in the KPFA studios. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff. This interview was digitized, remastered, and re-edited in November 2024 and has not been heard for over 25 years. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky radio shows on Facebook.